everybody. Welcome to another episode of Points on the Board. Do we have another exciting show for you today? You know, people use the term exciting. We have more of a show where you will learn a lot and you will remember a lot. Because today we are going to talk about the Duke lacrosse case. We are going to revisit it, thanks to Crystal Mangum. The only game that was played those days was the racial hate game. All this stuff that you see now, George Floyd, BLM, there are moments in history, and this Duke lacrosse game was one of them. And we also have a personal touch to it, as my co-host Big Bill Ross has a connection to that. Then we're going to move on to Bill Belichick's last stand, where the NFL says no, college says, why not? Bill Belichick going to UNC, and we're going to get Bill's take as well on that. He played college ball. He knows the mentality. He knows how it is to deal with the recruiting, with the coaches. He knows that whole world. And then we're going to go to Devondre's dramatic exit. When I don't want to becomes a career highlight. That's what he's good. In other words, that's what he will be remembered as. And once again, I'm going to lean on my co-host here, Big Bill Ross, who did play some college ball. I played high school. I was in the military. I was all that. You got to have your peers back. You got to have your comrades back, for lack of a better word. So we're going to talk about that. And then I'm going to ask Bill, what is his favorite holiday tradition? Bill has a special family. Everybody has a special family in their eyes. But Bill, he has a wife who they dearly love each other. They take care towards one another, and she has an issue, and I'll let Bill talk about that if he wants. But he also has five girls. You know, Mr. Testosterone there with five girls. So we're going to find out what his holiday traditions are. And with that, let me introduce myself. I am William Del Pilar. Most of you know me as a conservative Latino on my Conservative Talk podcast, Fired Up, with Bill's beautiful wife, Annette Ross, and Angie Mangani. And I have my co-host here, Mr. Bill Ross, the man himself. How are you doing, Bill?
I'm doing great. I'm ready to roll here. Great topic today.
I think so. Well, let's get right down to it. We have some heavy topics here. First off, we need to give a hat tip to Let's Talk with Kat, K-A-T. Look that up. Let's Talk with Kat.com. She's the one who broke the story, and it kind of bothers me a bit, Bill. She isn't getting her credit. You're seeing the videos. You're seeing all of this coming up with the Duke lacrosse. And what I am referencing is in a shocking twist that has reignited the debates about justice, media ethics, and, of course, racial dynamics in America. Crystal Mangum, who is the woman at the center of the infamous Duke lacrosse case, has finally admitted, after nearly 20 years, that she fabricated the entire story. Or as my sailor friend said last night, that hoe lied. I said, dude, that's kind of harsh. But he's still angry about how all that went down. And we were in North Carolina when that happened. And I said, that's harsh because I saw the interview on Let's Talk with Kat. And Bill, it sounds like a broken woman. It sounds like a woman who has found God, but she's also a bit broken. Her life has not been kind to her. Granted, these are her own decisions as to her lot in life. But I didn't know how to feel about her. You know, at first it was anger, hatred, resentment at her creating this racial divide. And at the end of the day, I just see a sad person who I pity, but I don't know how to feel about. But to revisit to the audience who may be too young to have realized what happened or have forgotten, Crystal Mangum accused three Duke University lacrosse players, David Evans, Colin Finnerty, and Reed Seligman, of rape in 2006. Now, this pre-internet, the internet was around, but not how it is today with the social media, et cetera, et cetera. There were websites posting on it, but it wasn't the average person with the debate. And it sparked a national scandal. And it was fueled by media sensationalism. Think progressives. They're guilty. They're guilty. Rich white boys, which fueled racial tensions. You had black mobs screaming, kill them, castrate them. It was, and the media was egging them on. And nobody was defending the Duke lacrosse boys. And as soon as you started to hear more about the information, red flags started coming up. You know, so it was a bad case. It was not the hill to die on for racial justice, and all it did was create and generate hate. And that's what made it so contentious. And people, I'm not telling you how I feel, Bill feels, or anybody feels. I'm telling you how it went down and what the nation was going through at the time. She claimed her Mangum was working as a part-time stripper at the time. And again, she came forward just this month, December, to confess that her allegations against the players were completely made up. Everybody knew that. The evidence pretty much stated that. She had never officially come out and said that. She claimed her motivations were rooted in a desperate need for validation, not from God, but from the public eye, essentially admitting she sold her story for the spotlight, living up to the very stereotype of a stripper she might have hoped to escape, meaning we don't think highly of strippers. And that's wrong. It's a legal profession. They're trying to earn some money. Many women have become strippers and put their pay their way through college, become doctors. So we need to look at having some respect and some dignity, regardless of the job somebody has, whether we like it or not. But sadly, that's how people are looking at it. Bill, before we get into the videos, before we get into details about all of this, the Duke lacrosse coach, I'm digressing a bit by moving forward, but the Duke lacrosse coach was forced to resign. He had nothing to do with it, had done nothing wrong. That's how far the hate went. Everybody associated, especially if you were Anglo, you became a target. Bill, you heard me talk about all this. You heard me talk about her in today's with the confession. You have a tie, an indirect tie. Talk to us about that. But before that, what are your thoughts based off this intro here and what's happened and what's going down?
Well, you know, it reminds me obviously a lot of what's been going on today. And we've touched on, you know, San Jose and whatnot. But, you know, the climate, right? It was a little bit ahead of its time when it comes to that. But, you know, obviously, it was highly disappointing how the institution handled it. You know, they really let the players out, you know, hung the players out to dry, so to speak. And obviously, there was a lot of other players affected by this. You know, there were three main players that were involved in the lawsuit. So it was highly disappointing to me. And I also, you know, had some people from Connecticut that were on that team. And I myself competed against Pressler as an assistant coach to Wilton in some of the summer leagues, in a short stint as a varsity assistant. So we were rivals. And when we were playing each other, obviously I didn't like him that much, but I really felt for him in that situation because, you know, Duke obviously was a perennial top 10 program before this happened. And then, you know, it really took a toll, and we can go into that later, but, you know, it took a toll on the program, and he transferred to, you know, Bryant and was very successful there. Now is in Texas doing a professional and high school lacrosse. So, you know, that, you know, it was sad to see that he had to move on and how it affected the program and the players that, also had to transfer with the season canceled and whatnot.
Oh, exactly. It was a tough, it was an ugly situation for everyone involved. So that is the picture of Crystal Mangum today. Before we get into, well, let's get into what happened. Then I want to show her confession. That's Crystal Mangum. Let's remove her from there. We'll bring her back up here in a second. As it all starts, it starts with a man's Johnson asking, Crystal Mangum and another individual were strippers, brought to a party. The argument at the party started reportedly over payment issues and behavior of some attendees. In essence, they didn't want to pay us what had been agreed upon. But Mangum and Roberts arrived to perform, but there were complaints from dancers about the conduct of some of the team members, including racial slurs and inappropriate behavior. There was also an issue with how much money was offered for the performances. The dancers claimed, again, they were promised a certain amount but were not offered what was promised. And so an altercation ensued, and it escalated when Mangum and Roberts argued with some of the players, and that led to a chaotic scene where Mangum left the bath. She ran to a bathroom, and that's when things started to really go south, locking herself in. And then after she left the bathroom, there was some kind of confrontation. She was wandering around in the front yard. They left at that point. They had left the party, but there were still an additional altercation as they were leaving, and it necessitated police intervention. In essence, it was a clusterfuck that nobody really knows what happened, and you have 10 zillion witnesses, 10 zillion stories. But what I told you is pretty much the gist of it. The arguments in court dealt with what he said, she said, what the evidence said, meaning the rape kits and things like that, after the accusation started to fly. So following those events, Megan made her allegations after being taken into a medical facility. And she was initially set for involuntary commitment due to behavior and intoxication. She was messed up. She was like, Lululand out there. And so her accusations were based on tumultuous events that night, but it lacked any corroboration from Roberts. And there were so many inconsistencies in her story, it eventually led to the collapse. Now, Phil, this is how it went down. My issue was, had an investigation been properly done, a proper DA had been there, I don't think any of this would have happened. What are your thoughts initially before we go into the confession?
Well, no, I agree with that. I mean, obviously there's political motivation here, you know, with, I believe there was an election coming up, if I'm not mistaken. And I think it fell on the institution too, to at first protect the players and the team and really do their own investigation. And I don't think anybody really dug in too deep on this. They really jumped to conclusions. And once again, you know, one person's allegations, not that sports is the only thing that we live for, right? But, you know, it canceled the whole season. It's going to have a lifetime effect on all of them, but especially the three guys. So there's a duty to really fulfill, you're innocent until proven guilty, and to fulfill that investigation as well as you
right.
can. I don't think they actually, you know, really attempted to do that.
Right, exactly. So in essence, from the get-go, it was a cluster. So quickly, the timeline of the events, March 13th. This is in 2006, the party where the alleged incident occurred. April 17th, indictments came down against David Evans, Colin Finnerty, and Reed Seligman. And those indictments were based off of pretty shady evidence. She couldn't pick anybody out of the lineup. The lineup was just a Duke lacrosse team. So in essence, the fixer was in. You know, when you do a lineup, you're supposed to have, hey, Joe, come on over. You know, the cop who's on duty needs you in this lineup. It's supposed to be extremely diverse. And she couldn't even pick him out of the Duke lacrosse lineup. And then the person she picked originally wasn't even at the party or had already left when everything went down. But they managed to finagle Colin Finnerty, David Evans, and Reed Seligman. That was in April 17, 2006. Approximately a year later, the original DA was thrown aside. I was going to say thrown under the bus, but he wasn't thrown under the bus. In essence, he was driving the bus, throwing justice under the bus. So eventually, the North Carolina Attorney General, Roy Cooper, who went on to become a very bigoted governor of North Carolina. By bigoted, not racially. I'm talking about just his belief systems in terms of how he ruled, but not a very good governor in my eyes. But he did the right thing. He took over as attorney general. He dropped all charges and declared the players innocent. And he did that based off the evidence. Now, here is her confession stating as such that she lied, which is why Roy Cooper dropped all the charges, because his conclusion based off the evidence was this woman is lying.
And
can you hear that, Bill?
I testified falsely against them by saying that they raped me when they didn't, and that was wrong. And I betrayed the trust of a lot of other people who believed in me. And made up a story that wasn't true because I wanted validation from people and not from God. And that was wrong. And I hope that they can forgive me.
Again, let's give credit where credit is due. That is Let's Talk Cat. And in fact, you know what I'm going to do, Bill, here real quick? Let us bring up her webpage. here to give that credit to. But while I'm doing that, Bill, what are your thoughts on her confession there?
Well, I mean, you know, forgiveness is very important in my world. But, you know, what we're 18 years out and asking them for forgiveness is a very tough call. I mean, I'm sure they've all moved on. There was legal settlements, financial, you know, compensation. You know, so maybe it's a bit easier to forgive now, but that's a tall order in a sense, 18 years later.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And here's the website. It's called Let's Talk with Kat. I want to give her due. Everybody is running with this, and this is the type of story that should help launch Let's Talk with Kat, but nobody's referencing her or giving her credit. Now, why am I doing this? Because it's the right thing to do, and as a small organization, that would be my biggest nightmare, to break a story wide open and nobody credits us, because that's how you grow. So kudos to Let's Talk with Kat. It seems to me that she kind of found the Lord, but she's still in jail, and she's appealing. So some people may look at it cynically, and maybe it is, but I got the feeling based on how she was talking. I don't want to say she's completely innocent as much as I don't know what to think. She came across as a little bit genuine, but the circumstances as to why she may be doing this. And at the end of the day, it's I have just come to the conclusion there is something the matter with her mentally. She's not mentally slow. She's not mentally messed up. But I really wonder if she understands the ramifications of what she did. That's what I do wonder. Okay, so I've given you the timeline of those events. And the initial media coverage, Bill, and public perception, there was, you remember this, there was a national and local media initially portrayed the case as privilege, race, and sexual assault. That was it. It was like, and I even looked at it that way early on. Why? It's Duke. Only rich people go to Duke. I don't know which one of these three individuals, but one was on there on scholarship from a working class family. It's every poor and working class family's parents' dreams. My kid's going to Duke. And they lumped him in with the rest of the rich white kids. And that was a disservice by the media that was all over this. In a sense, white privilege. Or it wasn't white privilege at the time, it was privilege, race, and sexual assault. But it was like all those white people. And then the backdrop being the South did not help, which as somebody who grew up and lived in the South, I have seen more racism in San Diego. I have seen more racism in New York City. I have seen more racism in every part of the country than I have in the South. My case in point, real quick, and I digress, Bill, but this is very important to me. The Charleston, when that bad cop murder that black kid, shot him, or I don't know if he died, but shot him 6 times in the back. There weren't race riots. There weren't riots. You know why? Because the faith is very strong in the South. Ferguson, well, wait, what about Ferguson? All those were outsiders that came in and ginned up a lie. Hands up, don't shoot. That was a lie. So I will defend the South to the day I die. Why? Because 65% of blacks still live in the South. They have grown to get along, and the church has done has had a big role in that. But that said, the perception of the backdrop being in the South did not help. There was a rush to judgment by the media in assuming the player's guilt. Even the professors at Duke University all signed a letter condemning these kids. As Bill stated, his nemesis was forced to resign. You know, what are your thoughts, Bill, on the initial media coverage?
Well, I mean, obviously, it was obvious that they are just looking for a story. They always are, right? And they have a responsibility to dig in on the story before they take it to the level that they did. And they rushed to judgment, and they just took the story and ran with it. I mean, you know, I've been to that campus, and there is a lot of have and have-nots around the campus in Durham. So, I mean, I can understand some of the attitude or the perception. But, you know, you have a responsibility to dig in and find out what happened to the best of your ability and have a balanced report. Now, obviously, today we see the same stuff happening. It's very one-sided. So, you know, that was disappointing as well. I'll make one comment that we always beat Wilton, by the way. And so he was my nemesis, but we always came out victorious. But, yeah, so that was really disappointing. And, you know, the media should, you know, and I'm sure they do, but, you know, use that as a lesson, you know, in communication schools across the country.
And as Bill noted, The entire lacrosse team faced significant scrutiny and backlash. The whole team was suspended for the season. There are kids on scholarship who weren't rich, who were depending on the lacrosse. And the season was canceled. And the impact, the whole team, not just the three, as we said, the head coach was forced to resign. We haven't talked about Mike Nifong, and we will here shortly. He was the district attorney who loved the limelight and was feeding. So to defend the media, briefly early on, they were being fed all of this hate on a platter by a district attorney who was hiding evidence. Not, you know, we'll get to that here. I'm digressing slightly. So again, to review real quick, the players involved, the three Duke lacrosse players, David Evans, Colin Finnerty, and Reed Seligman. They were accused by Crystal Mangum. It affected the whole team. It affected the campus. It affected the nation. The progressive outlets were pushing the false narrative. Even after they began to see the red flags, they still ignored the red flags. It's kind of like in a movie when you see the helicopter shot of the movie and you see the car driving on the freeway. And then you look ahead. Hey, that freeway ends. There's nothing after that, you know. It's like they were just ignoring all the signs and heading off the freeway, the media was. So real quick on Crystal Mangum. She was 27-year-old student at North Carolina Central University. Not that it matters, but that's one of those all-black universities, one of those, I forget what they call them, there's a term for these all-black universities, very historical, deep, rich history. And before you knock a black historical university, there was a time black students could not get in to college. So this is how they got their degrees, and God bless them for that. She was a student there, studying psychology, and she worked part-time as an exotic dancer. Before y'all play this race card or go, many beautiful, gorgeous white women have done that. I knew one. She was hired through an escort service bill to perform as a stripper. She was one of two dancers present. And the other dancer, her name is Kim Roberts. We're going to talk about her because her testimony was important. All of this happened because of an argument and altercation, and she eventually accused the three players of rape. After the lacrosse case, Mangum's life continued to spiral downward. And when I say continued to spiral downward, when the boys weren't charged and it came out that she lied, that alone ends most people's lives and careers. But then in 2010, she was arrested for attempted murder, arson, and other charges related to an incident with her boyfriend at the time, Milton Walker. Then in 2013, she was convicted of second-degree murder for stabbing her boyfriend, Reginald Day, to death and is currently serving a prison sentence. Hence the interview from prison. She's on appeal. She has three kids, I think. She wants to see them. She wants to get her life back. And finally, to culminate who Crystal Mangum is, December 2024, this month, she admitted in an interview with Kat that she had fabricated the rape allegations. Bill, when I hear this story, it's easy to hate on her. Then I see the interview. Then being at my age now, I tend to look at life differently. And it's, again, at the end of the day, I don't know what to think, but I just see it's sad. It's pathetic. This is why, to me, it's so important to have a good nuclear family in place. What are your thoughts on Crystal Mangum, her background, her later legal issues?
Well, to start, when this occurred, obviously, one of the things that you would think the law enforcement would do is look at who the person is, right? And in the allegations, and obviously there was another one that I think sort of conflicted her report. But, you know, she had her troubles. And if indeed, you know, she's actually, you know, found God and cleaned up her life, so to speak, and, you know, we're all entitled to changing, you know, who we are and become a better person, right? So, right. I mean, if she's done that, I applaud her. Obviously, you know, that situation was awful, and she really, in herself, affected so many people. You know, that's a disgrace, so to speak. But, you know, I'll give her credit for, if indeed true, turning her life around. And we're all entitled to, you know, move on and you know, try to better our situation.
That is true. That's a good take there, Bill. Now, as I said, she was hired with another stripper, and her name is Kim Roberts. That's not her name now. I think she's probably married or something now, because when I was doing research, a different name came up. But at the time, it was Kim Roberts. She was pivotal because her testimony immediately started showing it wasn't cracks in the foundation. It was as if 9.1 had hit. Those were like just split open foundations of holes in the story of Crystal Mangum, because she provided a different narrative. She was crucial in highlighting the inconsistencies. So when you hear her, when you look at the greater picture, you realize this case underscored the issues with prosecutorial misconduct, the impact of media on legal proceedings, and the consequences of false accusations. And she was the one who broke that open. Now, Bill, just a clear case here. When I first researched, I had completely forgotten about her. Did you remember that she was part of the story?
Not today, I didn't. And I actually believe she was fairly in the background, probably by design, right?
Yes.
As far as the reporting goes. So, yeah, no, she's not a major person in the case from a listener.
Why was she in the background?
Well, that was intentional, I believe.
Because she contradicted Crystal Mangum.
Right.
Why put her to the forefront? So, yeah. Okay, and I apologize. I just want to keep moving here. My sincere apologies on that, Bill. Mike Nifong. We're all familiar with Nifong. Did you have any special relationships with him, Bill? I'm teasing.
No, I did not.
Mike Nifong was a Durham County District Attorney at the time of the case. Duke is part of the Tri-City area, Raleigh-Durham, and Durham is one of the major cities in North Carolina. It's not a large, large city, but it's one of the bigger hubs that's growing and becoming a player, Raleigh-Durham area there. So this was major. He was a major player, meaning what I'm trying to say is most people look at us as hicks there in North Carolina. This was a modernized, that's a term, cosmopolitan city, Durham. And Mike Nifong, a Democrat, was aggressively pursuing the case against the players. He made numerous public statements that didn't suggest their guilt, but pretty much said they're guilty. And it was like throwing fuel on a fire before all the evidence was evaluated and disclosed. He withheld exculpatory DNA evidence from the defense, Bill. He withheld a DNA test that showed there was no genetic material from any of the lacrosse players found on the accuser, Crystal Mangum. But they did find a handful of other players. I mean, not players, a handful of other individuals, not any of the accused, though. So instead of providing this exculpatory evidence, he only turned over a partial report. He hid evidence, and that misled the court and the defense team about the absence of DNA evidence. No, so most of us not being of legal minds, Bill, I had to look up exculpatory, because that's how I am. I want to make sure our research is done top notch. And exculpatory means evidence or information that clears or tends to clear someone from charges or blame. That's it. You know, in fact, I think I heard Megyn Kelly. I'm a big fan of her show. Her show is not quite as good as mine and Bill's, but I'm kidding. Check her out. She said it best. Game over. That alone should be game over. Your thoughts on that gross miscarriage of justice towards the innocent party, the three boys, in defense of trying to get reelected. Mike Nifong was up for reelection, and he was playing it to the best he could to get reelected. Your thoughts on Nifong here and the DNA evidence?
Well, obviously, I have a big problem with him in general, because I think he's the real villain in this whole, issue and this whole happening, right? Because, as a DA, he's a leader in the community. He has, he needs to lead the community, and sometimes as a leader, you need to make tough decisions. And he took the easy way out here just from a political standpoint. But, ultimately, you look at the individuals and the girls involved, but he's the real villain in this, whole situation. And it's unfortunate that, he saw fit to, you know, hide evidence, you know, that would exonerate, the, you know, the players and whatnot. And it's really disappointing that someone with that legal position would do so.
And the abuse of power is what you're saying. And that wasn't all. So there's tons of videos, but being a little pressed for time, I just want to read you a couple of the quotes. He made comments to the media like, I'm not going to allow Durham to be known for a bunch of lacrosse players from Duke raping a black girl. That is inflammatory. It's prejudicial. It helped contribute to the narrative of racial tension, i.e. racial hate. And he assumed guilt. He was influencing public perception and also potentially fairness in the trial. You know, and so he pursued the case despite the evidential inconsistencies, i.e. the DNA evidence. And then she also Bill changed details about who was involved and what exactly happened. He continued to push this case forward. And again, he was in a tight Democratic primary for re-election as Durham County DA. And his aggressive pursuit, this was nothing but an attempt to appeal to voters by stating, I'm your man, Black Durham constituents. I will protect you. I will be tough on racial crime and sensitive to racial issues. When that was none of the case here. Bill, your thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, it's very disappointing. And I believe, if I recall, he doubled down a few times when things started coming out along the way. Again, it's you know, he had a chance to, you know, step up as a leader and actually explain, you know, everything that happened, the evidence and what he found, instead of hiding it. I think the community would have accepted it. I mean, he's actually doing a disservice and, you know, assuming that the community didn't have the smarts or the intelligence or, you know, as people to, you know, take all the evidence and make their own, you know, decisions on what they thought happened. You know, so again, as you said, it's extreme abuse of power.
All right. I want to get your quick takes on this. In January 2007, North Carolina Attorney General Roy Cooper took over the case. He thoroughly reviewed it, and again, as I said earlier, April 11th, he dismissed the players. Cooper declared the players, quote, innocent, unquote, rather than just, quote, not guilty, unquote, emphasizing there was no evidence against them. And that was important. What he was saying is, they're not guilty, not because of a trial or anything like that. They're not guilty because they're just completely innocent from what this moron you see on screen did. Bill, it took a year. Should this case have taken, real quick, how long should this case have taken once that did, based off your remembrance?
Well, I mean, I believe it should have been, you know, wrapped up much quicker than that. I realize, you know, that you want to be thorough. It's unfortunate if they weren't that thorough in the very beginning, right? You know, maybe we wouldn't have been left to the end result, you know, so far down the road. But, you know, it is what it is, but it was really disappointing that it took so long.
Yes, it is. And, I've always wondered as a child, whatever happened to the Constitution or one of the amendments there, you know, our right to a speedy trial.
Yeah.
So the aftermath of settlements. In June 2007, Duke University reached a settlement with the three falsely accused players. Terms were not disclosed. There is one report that states it could have been as high as $20 million per student, those three students. They also filed suit against the city of Durham. They settled for about $5 million. I think it was a fair settlement at the time. I don't know what inflation would account for. Somebody could argue, hey, it should have been much, much more. I'm not going to say no, it shouldn't have. But I thought, had it been like a couple million, I'm like, oh, man, they got screwed over by Duke. Because with Duke sided with the stripper. Their actions sided with the stripper. What do you think of the settlement being as high as potentially $20 million back in 2006 or 7?
Well, you know, I mean, I'd look at it a little bit differently because I was involved in a malpractice suit at the time And, yeah, and so, you know, our settlement with the hospital, an anesthesiologist who, you know, made a bad mistake with an epidural and was on fentanyl, it was about a third of that. And then, of course, lawyers take a third of that. So yeah, I really actually feel it was a high. You know, I do believe, you know, Duke was another villain, but in my opinion, it was a high dollar amount, especially for that time.
Okay, so that would be worth $2 million. Oh, I put $2 million. It's $20 million. So it's about $30 million in today's dollars.
Right.
Yeah. The only pushback I would give is this was nationwide. These kids' lives were likely ruined just from the perspective, well, you're innocent, but y'all still shouldn't have hired those strippers. Y'all shouldn't have done this. Y'all shouldn't have done that. And who wants to be seen as, you hired those Duke guys to go work for you? And eventually, I don't know how they're all doing, but supposedly they've all gone on. This is probably, hearing the story probably doesn't do them anything of note in terms of positivity and having it brought back up. The media self-reflection, Bill. Some progressive outlets kept it up. They refused to not believe what was happening, and they continued to condemn the boys by stating or claiming, well, it's still systemic racism at Duke. It's still this. It's still that. Yeah. You know, your thought. Now, some media outlets issued corrections for the initial coverage. But two questions for you here to quickly respond. Your thoughts on the outlets that kept up the attacks and talking about systemic racism. And has the media really learned anything from that case?
Well, no, obviously they haven't, because they continue to do the same thing. I mean, they push a narrative even when they know it's false. It probably, in actuality, is worse now than it was back then. So, you know, again, that was another part of it that was very disappointing. They have a responsibility, and they failed. You know, they failed the public by continuing to stir the pot. But again, it's worse now than it was then.
Exactly. Before I forget, people, I want to show you a picture. I purposely didn't want to put the kids. They're grown men now. I mean, heck, they were older. They were younger than me back then. But they're full grown men. But you know, it's their lives were violated wrongly. But this is who they are. I got some pictures of them from back then. And three young kids, all waspish. You know, it made for great progressive media coverage, and hopefully they're leading solid lives. Now, a couple of things before we move on. He was disbarred. He only served one day in jail, but he stayed out of the public eye, and that is Mike Nifong, the bigoted piece of shit excuse for a human being who was willing to destroy people's lives so he could get a higher pension by getting reelected. You know, there nobody really knows what he's doing now. I think if I dug deep enough, I would have found out, but he's a scumbag, you know. But he's been disbarred, Bill. He can't practice law. He filed for bankruptcy in 2008 due to the legal fees and costs associated with the fallout for the Duke lacrosse case. I'm sure he probably faced lawsuits from the families, too. He hasn't held any public or legal position since his disbarment. He's effectively his career in law and politics, because the district attorney office is launching pad towards higher politics. And we talk about how he wanted a bigger pension, et cetera. He was probably looking towards higher office had this gone the way he wanted. Sadly, he retained his pension despite his actions. You know, so he's collecting those state employee benefits. Yeah. Again, only a one-day jail sentence. Bill, my question to you is he getting what he deserved, or should he have my only issue with this is I think he should have gotten some jail time. But overall, I think he's gotten his just desserts. Your thoughts?
Well, I think he should have lost his pension. I mean, what he did was extreme, right? So and actually had a longer time in jail. There's people that do less that are in jail longer. They lose tenure or whatever it might be when they're involved in education for lesser offenses. So I think he actually got off retaining his pension, you know, for what he did. I know he's had a tough time afterwards, but I mean, you know, like I said, I feel like he's one of the villain in this whole affair.
Oh, I agree. I agree. And what this case highlights to you, America, is that we look at life in generalities. Guilty of this, guilty of that. He should do this, should do that. And I'm not pushing back, Bill, but the sad truth is once you start to break something down legally, you see how limited you are in punishment or certain actions you can pursue. While on the surface, we equate this action as similar and equivalent to this other action legally, that's not the case many times. And I'll never forget this as a comic book aficionado. That's where I learned a lot of early lessons about good versus bad. And there was a Batman issue and Bruce Wayne. He was in a law class and somebody went up to him all anger. And he says, "You don't understand. This has nothing to do with justice. It has everything to do with the law in reference to what justice is not always carried out by the law. They are not always aligned, but we assume they are." You know, and that was the case with Mike Nifong in his one-day sentence. Crystal Mangum today. Crystal. She was sentenced in 2013 to serve between 14 to 18 years. Given that she was convicted in November 2013, her projected release date, people, is going to be right around February of next year. No, we are 2024. February 2026, assuming she serves the minimum sentence and does not receive parole or other sentence reductions. So that's where she stands. I think based off of this alone, if I'm on that parole board, see, here's the distinction where I'm wrong. You can't judge her based off her lacrosse incidents and this confession on her current term. But, man, you know, it's kind of so I don't know what she should get based off the case. But, man, she should have done some time for the lacrosse crap, and she never did. And, Bill, that's where we end today. Any final comments before I close it out, the segment?
No, I mean, it's obviously just a sad case in general. And, you know, I'm glad that, you know, it's been wrapped up. But, you know, there's not much more to say. It's just, you know, it was an awful situation. And I hope they all moved on and are having successful lives, so to speak.
Right. I agree. So how society looks at it in general terms, they look at it as, well, there's a lot of issues to be talked that we need to discuss in terms of false accusations, prosecutorial misconduct. And we need to have that talk about the intersection of race, class, and justice. This is a cautionary tale about the dangers of rushing to judgment and the importance of due process. That's what they say every fucking time this happens. And this has happened multiple times since that case. So these are just nice, pretty words that society likes to say after it. Here's the ugly truth. The Duke lacrosse case mirrors the rush to judgment with no evidence, as we have seen in George Floyd, Michael Brown's "hands up, don't shoot," Jussie Smollett's. It's Smollett. I like saying Smollett. Throw the French accent in there. Jussie Smollett's hoax. And the Jordan Neely case, i.e. Daniel Penny being taken down because he was Anglo over Jordan Neely being black, where initial narratives have been fueled by the media, by a political agenda that purposely overshadows the truth. That's what's happened since then. So this talk that I told you and how the society wants to look at it is just that. I want to pressure you people. This isn't about black and white. This issue isn't solely about racial issues, but it reflects a strategy used by elites and politicians who want to keep us divided. You know, they want to keep us at each other's throats, because by focusing on that conflict, by focusing our hate and directing it towards one another, they distract from the real issues. And that is specifically the erosion of our freedoms, economic disparities, and the expansion of government control. I have seen this firsthand in my mother's country of Panama, where my formative years are in terms of growing up. This is the same playbook. It's in every country. We are no different. If we're fighting each other, we miss the real power plays that allow those in control to manipulate laws and policies for their benefit, as we have seen over and over and over. Look here in California. They have manipulated the laws and policies for an example, by reducing felonies and misdemeanors, by telling citizens who call 911, stop calling 911 or we're going to go after you, by policemen knowing that person is not going to be prosecuted, so not even bothering to arrest him. And in turn, our society of elites comes out and says, oh, look, crime is down. Why? Well, if you're not reporting it, you're not doing any arrests, you're dropping felonies and misdemeanors. That's how they manipulate, then crime is statistically down. But it really isn't. That's one example of how they manipulate laws and policies for their benefit, and we're the ones who suffer. We must stop and understand who the real enemy is here. It's those who seek power and enrichment. And it's not always elites. Mike Nifong wanted to become an elite. Crystal Mangum did it out of bitterness, anger, hatred, and probably a payday down the road because it was Duke after all. So be aware it's big government and elites who would lord over us with impunity that keeps this tribalism going. We've got to come to the table. I come from a family of white, black, and brown, and that's why I am so passionate about this. Bill, he looks like a nice, happy, good-looking German. I'm kidding.
I am kidding. Norwegian, so you're close.
There you go. And with that, my friends, let us move on. You know what, Bill? I want to we're going to do Belichick's let's do Belichick here. I was just looking at our time, but let's get to it. Bill Belichick, unexpected move to UNC. Bill Belichick, people, is 72 years old. He's going to take over as a University of North Carolina football program. Anything can happen in sports, especially when Belichick's involved. Quickly, Bill, give me your first thoughts when you heard Belichick to UNC as a former college player and as somebody who follows the NFL.
Well, I wasn't that surprised because I'm sure he misses it, because once a coach, always a coach, and it's been his life for so many years, you know, decades, that, you know, when you see an opportunity to get back in a game that you love or do something that you love. I know he's been doing a lot of commentary and he's been getting, you know, rave reviews from most people, but that's what he loves to do. So I'm really not surprised. And I think it's a nice move by UNC because, you know, Belichick has a lot of respect, what, you know, around the, you know, sport, obviously. Young players know who he was and know how successful he was. And all in all, probably very excited to get an opportunity to play for him. And I think it, you know, depends on his success depends on, you know, not only how he handles sort of a new environment, which I think he'll do fine with, but also his assistants and who he hires and who he brings in to deal with the complexity of college sports as it is today.
Right. I agree. Belichick has made the news with coaching hires before. You know, Paul Tagliabue had to intervene when he was involved in the charade as the head coach of the New York Jets. The Jets eventually sent draft picks to the Patriots that allowed Parcells to become their head coach and Belichick on his staff. What they tried to do, Bill, was it's pretty complex, but they introduced Belichick as a head coach at a news conference while Parcells was to be a consultant. They were trying to circumvent Parcells' contract with the Patriots, and Paul Tagliabue came in and said, no, 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 no. That was case number one. That was 1997. As I said, the Jets eventually sent draft picks to the Patriots, and Parcells came on to become their head coach. And then in 2000, the one he's most famous for is he resigned as the head coach of the Jets by writing, I resign as head coach of the New York Jets, unquote, on just those pieces of paper at his very first introduction press conference. So he resigned after one day after being officially appointed. Parcells has set it up for him to take over. Supposedly he felt constrained by the organization, wanted to distance himself by the influence of Parcells, who was overshadowing him. At the end of the day, we'll never know the full truth. His legacy, Bill, 9 Super Bowls. He won 6. I don't know if they'll reach this one, the cement his NFL legacy. He needs 14 more wins to match Don Shula's record of 344 total coaching victories. And it's not something he's likely to get in one season. I mean, so that's a couple more seasons. He's 72. So going to UNC, which announced his hiring December 11th, just last week, to a 5-year deal worth $50 million, as you can see in that image there, that was probably his pressure there. your thoughts on Bill Parcells, Bill Belichick, the man, the myth, and why do you think he decided to go to UNC?
Well, again, I think, you know, he loves the sport. You know, he's passionate about it. It's been the majority of his professional life, obviously, and been very successful. So, you know, I think it's an exciting opportunity for him. It's much different from going from the NFL to college than it is from college to the NFL. So obviously, if you look, there's been some of his assistants have not done well in college, but he himself, I believe, will be able to handle it. And again, putting together the right people is important. He also can create a legacy there because if he does it right and he gets the right people in there, you know, one of his assistants can then take over for him and possibly be successful for, you know, years to come.
Okay. Yeah. So you're saying he's going to have success there.
Yes.
I get that. Okay. As you stated, his entire career has been in the NFL. Real quick, let's talk about some of his media work. You know, he's become a fan favorite on Manning Cast. I had never watched one episode of the Manning Cast. I'm not a Manning fan. I think he's one of the most overrated quarterbacks in the history of the NFL. Am I saying he wasn't a great quarterback? No, I'm not. But there are a dime a dozen in the NFL when you look at this fan of the history of the NFL. He doesn't even rate in the top 10. People will throw him in there, but we live in an aerial era that, you know, he never caught his plays. He wasn't very mobile. It's like he had to be on the team. My validation of my statement is simple. Look at his last Super Bowl. He wasn't even slated to start. They put him in the starting lineup. And it was the defense that won that Super Bowl. He actually hindered that team overall that season, him and Brock Osweiler. And the Super Bowl before that, the Seahawks destroyed him, embarrassed him. That, to me, is why the legacy of the Manning is going to be mixed. I bring reality to the table. So I've never been a fan. So I'm not a fan, so I have no reason to watch Manning Cast. But he's supposed to be a big hit. Bill, he also does other things inside the NFL. The Pat McAfee Show. He hosts a talk on Sirius XM called Let's Go. The Breakdown, he co-hosts with Peyton Manning that streams on ESPN Plus where they analyze the upcoming game. Coach is the name of it. Belichick owns his own football show on Underdog Fantasy YouTube channel. That's his contract book there. And the 33rd team, he serves as strategic advisor. The man has been busy. This is a non-pressure type gig. And he's giving all that up. So real quick, your thoughts on Bill Belichick, the media personality who no one saw this coming because he's so boring and a man of few words. Yet look at all that.
Well, I actually think he does a great job because as a coach myself and a player, you know, he really breaks it down and simplifies the game, for viewers, which doesn't really happen on regular broadcasts, right? So, you know, he gets into some more detail, which I find very interesting and it's educational. And at times, you know, he can be, you know, his personality surprises me. I think he mixes in well on that show and some of the other things he does. So, you know, I feel like he does a great job, you know, educating people about the game and what goes on behind the scenes, which you never hear from anyone else, especially during the regular network broadcasts, which are so vanilla. You know, it's annoying at times.
You know, you're right, because I had heard some clips and a play will start happening. He go, oh, Jesus, this is supposed to go here, here, here. And he's diagramming the play just as it ended or sometimes as once he sees it lay out. So, yeah, I do buy that. I also think the bar was so low for him. Fans are like, holy mackerel, this guy's pretty good. And he becomes a bit of a cult status because of that. People are shocked at that. Now he's replacing Mac Brown. Mac Brown has a national championship now with Texas. He got one, I believe. His overall record at UNC was 113-78-1, the winningest coach. He had two stints there. His second stint, 44-32, is why he is gone. Mac Brown was supposed to turn UNC into a national powerhouse. Instead, they're just a middling to poor ACC team. And the reason he was supposed to turn them into a powerhouse is the ACC champion gets an at-large bid to the BCS playoff series. You know? And so that's who Bill is. I think the bar is set low for Bill. Now, Steve Belichick is expected to join UNC's coaching staff after 1 year at Washington. Mike Lombardi. I have issues with Mike Lombardi. Oh, you know what? I need to remove that. I have issues with Mike Lombardi. Here's why. Most people know Mike Lombardi because he's a media analyst now. But in the trenches, he's a former assistant and NFL executive. He's going to serve as the general manager of the football program. He has the most important role for Belichick. His record as GM of the Browns was 4-12. He lasted one season. His last employment was in the front office, obviously, of the Patriots with Belichick in 2016. Since then, he's just done media work. Nobody wants to hire him. But he's held a good relationship with Bill Belichick. We're going to get back to him. Your thoughts real quick on Steve Belichick and Mike Lombardi coming in as two key individuals, key roles.
Well, I mean, I understand, you know, Steve, obviously, and, you know, he could be a candidate to step in and take his, take his place in the future. I think the NFL, you know, being a GM in the NFL is much different than running the, you know, the NIL and, you know, the recruiting and the portals and, you know, all of that. So I don't have any problem with it. I don't think Bill Parcells is going to take somebody on that's going to jeopardize, what he's trying to accomplish because,
That may not be true. He hired somebody who destroyed his Patriots draft. Do you know who that was?
You have to refresh my memory on that one.
He hired Bill Belichick himself as a draft guy. Yeah. Front office Bill destroyed head coach Bill. Yeah. I'm being dead serious when I say that, people, because that is kind of what happened. That's an image of Joe Lombardi there. And Bill is absolutely correct. Two different beasts. I just don't like what I'm seeing as he literally walks on water for some of the fans. I'm like, no, not really. Let's get real. But Bill is absolutely right. Everything he's done in the NFL is not directly related, but at the same time, I will push back, Bill, and say it is indirectly related to a T. They literally run side by side. And why is that? What have we talked about off and on the last couple of months? And you already mentioned the NIL. And what is NIL more akin to in the NFL than anything else? And that is free agency. So I think because he understands how free agency, because he understands the world of the NFL, that will serve him to be extremely successful in college because the NIL is in its infancy. And I think what they want to do, well, before I get your point, then let's go back to Belichick's vision. He wants to focus on player development and life skills, yada, yada, yada. Emphasize on training, nutrition, and professional techniques, yada, yada, yada. I say yada, yada, yada. I mean, those are norms. You know, he's aimed at preparing players for careers in football or beyond. Now, that's slightly different because the kids not only are going to make their money, they're going to have a foundation financially because most of these kids will not go to the pros. There's only 3,000 players in the NFL every year. There's probably 300,000 players at the college level, from Division I up. But here's the kicker what I'm referring to. He wants to run UNC like an NFL team, focusing on professional level training and schemes. And I get that. But most importantly, he wants to approach NIL as the NFL approaches free agency. Your thoughts on that?
Well, I think all that's, well and good, but the number one thing he wants to do is win, right? So all of that is around winning, and obviously he's a winner. Brady helped him with that, but, that's all great, but winning is the number one, thing in any sport, whether people tell you or not, that you agree with that or not. But, especially at that level in the NFL, winning is the objective. So anything that you do around the program is built in to win. And if you don't win, it doesn't matter what you're doing around the program. You won't be there very long, right? So, again, I think that it's a great base, but, you need to win.
But, Bill, isn't recruiting a symbiotic relationship to winning? It's kind of like the draft. That's what I mean by the process here. Recruiting is like the draft. You talk to these players, you interview these players. If you don't get the best players, you're not going to win.
Right.
The transfer portal and NIL, that's like free agency, And then facilities do sell professional players. I remember San Diego for years at Jack Murphy. They struggled with trying to sell players. Look at our state of the art. Bro, Jack Murphy's been dead. It's like the stadium's old, So fundraising and donor relations come into play. And it's also a year-round sport. So I do see – and the NFL has become a year-round sport
right.
in terms of working there. So I kind of – I don't want to push back as much as you're right. At the end of the day, you can do everything right. And if you still lose, you're going to get fired. Look at Mac Brown. But I think there's so many dynamics similar. It's all symbiotically related. You're not going to win just because you're the best X's and O's guys. You're not going to win just because you have the least injuries. You got to have the talent in there too. Now, do you think this could serve as a short-term gain for him here? Say he comes in, puts him on the map, gets him ranked in the top 20, and then an opening comes up in the NFL, and he has the opportunity to pursue those 14 wins and smash Dan. Well, he won't smash it. He'll squeak by Don Shula's most wins in the NFL record.
I don't think so. I think his Super Bowl record speaks for itself, right? I mean, I think that's the most amazing part of his, you know, tenure in the NFL. So, you know, I think he could end up being in North Carolina. That might be his swan song. And then one of his assistants takes over, you know, whether it's his son or not. But, you know, I'll push back on one comment that you made. You know, winning takes care of everything. Winning gets recruits. It brings in money. You know, so if you don't win, it doesn't matter what all those programs are. You're not going to bring people in that you want. You want the best people in the portal. You want to be able to pay them through the NIL, and you get those people through winning.
Right, right. I guess this is the chicken. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Because right. I'm not going to argue your point because, yeah, you're right. It does care everything. But they're not winning right now because they don't have the players on the field to win. So he needs to create this. He needs to come in with guns a-blazing on the non-winning aspect. What I mean by that is you're not going to win. So you need to focus all your drive, all your energy on the NIL, on recruiting, you know, on the fundraising to bring those players in. And once those players in, you become Alabama. You know, right. The program sells itself. Well, why do you want to go to Alabama? Well, hell, they're competing for the national championship every year. And look at the NFL. Their players are all over the place. So you're right. You're right in that sense. But you got to reach that level first. And I think because of the NIL, that dominance is now over. You're never going to see another – well, I don't want to say never, but you're unlikely to see the dominance of an Alabama, which also had help by soft schedules, the SEC controlling the NCAA, and all that's kind of gone now because Nevada, I guarantee you, those running rebels have a lot of billionaires. There's a lot of billionaires who graduated from various colleges who are now going to go, I can impact my alma mater. And turn their football team into a powerhouse. So I think those days are over. So I think it's going to be a symbiotic relationship. Final word before I close it out, Mr. Bill.
Well, I think his name speaks for itself, and he'll get talent right away that want to play for him because they know he was in the NFL, and they'll win, but they'll also get prepped for the NFL, which is part of his plan, right? So his name on its own will bring talent to that program.
I completely agree. So, look, people, hiring the NFL coaches for college roles, that often actually fails if you look at history because there's so many differences. And most people or a lot of people think because of his age, his personality, he's quiet, ornery, they think he's going to fail. I'm with Bill. To me, this move is a cultural shift in college football, and they're pushing for more professionalized programs, as we discussed with the NIL, with the recruiting. That's all being built with the NFL way of business as the structure. And Bill Belichick knows that. And as Bill Ross says, he's a legend. Ah, it's Bill Belichick. He's got 9 Super Bowls and 6 wins out of him. Oh, my God. His grumpiness can be aloof and help him, which means instead of having to spend an hour there and the parents eating it up, he just has to make a 10, 15-minute appearance because it's Grumpy Bill. But his legend precedes him. And USC football has historically been overshadowed by basketball. Belichick's reputation, his legendary status, that can help change that. I believe he will attract top talent. I believe he will enhance the performance. And I think USC has the opportunity to become a big-time player. And there you have it. All right, my friends. Let's move on to our final topic here. Devondre's dramatic exit when I don't want to play becomes your career highlight. So real quick, Big Bill, Devondre Campbell, you know, he attended Campbell, initially played at Hutchinson Community College, transferred to university. I'm sorry, I said he attended Campbell initially. I'm looking at that as university. Campbell, the band, initially played at Hutchinson Community College, transferred to University of Minnesota, fourth round selection by the Falcons, played for the Falcons for a few years, went to Arizona on a one-year deal. He was still trying to find his stride. Eventually wound up in Green Bay in 2021, played from there from 2021 to 2023. That's where I noticed his first documented issues with coaching staffs. He had a breakout year in 2021, first team All-Pro honors, led to a five-year contract extension. He proved to be pretty much a one-year wonder, meaning he was still a viable player, but that breakout year wasn't repeated as his performance declined the years after that, and that led to his release in 2024, meaning he didn't finish out his contract. His release came about, Bill, after he publicly criticized the Packers' defensive strategy and his utilization. He claimed that it came that his 2021 success came about because he didn't listen to the coaches. And he then went on to criticize the coaching staff for them not evolving and using him effectively. So he didn't finish the contract, went to the Niners in 2024 this year, signed a one-year, $5 million deal for one reason, just to fill in for Dre Greenlaw until he came back. That's my opening on Devondre Campbell. What are your thoughts on that, Bill?
Well, you know, obviously, you know, his issue in Green Bay wasn't a good one either, right? And the 49ers, if they hadn't had that issue, you know, I don't think he would have been picked up. I don't know. He probably would have found a home somewhere. But, you know, I don't think that the Niners, he would have even been a part of the Niners if he didn't need to fill that role. And he needs to understand that, right, that that was his role there. He's being paid handsomely to do it. So when asked to go back in, you're basically filling in again. So why not hop on the field and compete, you know, and support your brothers on the field? And, you know, obviously he decided not to do that. But there were some hints he was, you know, that's what he's all about.
Right, right, right. And the reason I kind of cut you off there, Bill, is you know what I did not do? I did not get the overview here. Why are we talking about Devondre Campbell? We're talking about Devondre Campbell because he signed with the 49ers for 1 year for $5 million to fill in for the injured Dre Greenlaw. That was his job. Last week, December 12, 2024, Campbell refused to enter the game when Dre Greenlaw was feeling some effects from his Achilles, his blown Achilles. You know, he takes some time. He wasn't going to come in and play the full 60 minutes. You know, Campbell was expected to come in and allow Greenlaw to get his rest of his feeling soreness, and that's what happened. He said, "No, coach, I'm not coming in." He was suited up, ready to play. If that was going to be his whole attitude, why even bother to suit up? Because he wanted to make that was his way of getting back at the team, in my opinion. Supposedly, this was due to frustration over losing the starting position to Greenlaw. He never had the starting position. He was a fill-in till Greenlaw came back. Bill, his teammates, including George Kittle and Charvarius Ward, they publicly criticized him. Selfish, immature. Shanahan didn't miss any bones neither, you know, stating that, yeah, he's not going to be part of us. We're figuring out the X's and O's about that right now. Linebacker Bart Scott suggested Campbell's refusal stemmed from pride and feelings slighted by the team dynamics after being demoted. Maybe so, but you're still under contract. Your thoughts on his refusal to play as a college player and as somebody watching it unfold?
It's a disgrace, so to speak. You know, I don't know what his particular reasons were, but you're going to get excommunicated from the team when you do that. I mean, he's already stepped in and done a nice job, and, you know, he's part of the team. They all appreciate that, but they don't appreciate what he did, you know, on the field. And obviously, you don't walk off on a, you know, a nationally televised game like that either, right? You know, it says a ton about you.
Yes.
And, you know, I believe he's going to have – if he stays with the Niners, they're going to have to do a lot of – you know, a lot of psychology, get him a psychologist or whatever they want to commit to, but I doubt they do. They just want to find a good way to move him, I would imagine.
Let's talk about that. And before we talk about that, any final thoughts in terms of you as a college player? What was your – I mean, you gave us an overview. When you saw that, or you first read about it, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
Well, the first thing I went through my mind is he's done. He's done with the team. He's going to lose respect from all the players, and the coaching staff, right?
Right.
So that was my immediate response. I've seen it happen in college. It happened on our team, too, during, triple days in the summer or whatever it might be. And it happened during the season a couple times. So, yeah, he would just be done with the team and, he's going to have to find a new home.
And you're right. Roberto Duran is my favorite boxer. Met him, ate at his restaurant, came up, have a nice picture of him. But I'll never forgive him for no mas. Meaning, look, he wasn't beating on you. He was just outboxing you. He was running from you. But he was winning on the points. He was proving the better boxer. You wanted a slugfest. You didn't get it. And you said, fuck you. If you're not going to fight, I'm not going to fight. But that's not how history will remember it. So it's unforgivable that you quit on your fans and you quit on yourself. And what people don't realize is Roberto Duran was at the end of his career at that point, where Sugar Ray Leonard was in entering his prime. So the fact that he beat him despite the cards being against him the first time, I thought was spectacular. But that said, I'm digressing. Let's get back to the point here. The suspension decision. I was talking to my partner, Big John. And he said, they need to release him. I said, no, they need to suspend his ass, then release him. That way, he'll be rewarded for cheating because of injury, somebody's going to sign him. Because his thought, Big John's thought is, nobody's going to sign him. I'm like, that's not how real world works. Somebody will rationalize the way to bring him on board to make a playoff push. That's just how life works. Sad but true. The San Francisco 49ers did what I recommended to them, even though they never called. And that is, they're suspending him for 3 games, and they're going, and which means he's not going to be paid a salary rather than release him. They don't have to pay him, and it also keeps him from signing elsewhere immediately. So there's also a rule, I don't know when it ends, where you can no longer sign players once playoffs begin. And I'm not sure if it will enter that part. But I expect the NFLPA to file a petition or argue this out somehow. But by suspending him and releasing him, they retain control over his contract. They can recover part of the signing bonus. And most importantly, they can send a strong message about conduct detrimental to the team. I expect that NFL is going to play neutral about this, but I expect behind closed doors, Bill, they're also telling – I wouldn't be shocked if they had a meeting with the NFL. And then the NFL said, no, we're going to support you on this one. The icing on the cake for them to be supportive of this is the players in that locker room are angry.
Right.
Your thoughts on the suspension, on the process that they're using here.
Well, I think it's the right process, right? I mean, there's no I in team, and it's more than just you, right? And he's showing you that it's about him, not the team. So I think they did the right thing. I agree with you. Someone would pick him up. So this is a way to control the situation and move on. So, I agree with that.
As the player who played college ball, as a competitor, I'm a competitor. I have played high school ball. But, I served in the military. You have to have people have to have your back in those times as well. Despite all of that and what it means to me, I think he still has a future in the NFL. I think somebody's going to sign him. If there's time to sign him after this wave, the suspension, somebody's going to look at him. But I think he will more likely not be in a roster entering training camp, but as injuries happen, he'll get looked at and could wind up on a team. Your thoughts on his potential? So if that doesn't happen, he's done. Meaning, in the perfect world, no injuries, no nothing, he's done. But I think because of injuries, the likelihood of him being looked at and being brought in is extremely high and then possibly being signed. Your thoughts?
Well, no, I agree. I mean, other than his, selfish behavior, his upside's high, right? He's, proven that. If he can get it together, there's injuries all the time. It's a rough sport. Somebody will pick him up like they pick other players up. I mean, they pick people up who have had problems with women. So they're definitely going to pick him up if they need him. It's a business. And if he's the best player out there, they're going to take a chance on him. Happens all the time.
I agree. All right, people. Look, Campbell's NFL tenure reflects a player with talent. At one point, he had a high ceiling. He's only been in the league 5 years, so you assume that high ceiling is still there. but it's also marked by challenges, with his biggest enemy being himself, his lack of ability to function within team dynamics, his personal attitude toward coaching and gameplay. And that personal attitude, I'm trying to say, reflects on it's never his fault. It's a coaching scheme. They don't know how to use him. Obviously, he's a selfish individual. He is his own worst enemy. This No Mas game is going to impact his future. To what extent, we don't know. But this highlights the importance of professionalism, team commitment, and how players demand you have their back when you are a team fighting the fight together. Only time will tell his future, but right now it's not very bright. All right, people, let's close it out. Bill, what are your favorite Christmas traditions you're looking forward to doing with the family? And don't tell me beating your wife is one of them.
No. I mean, we one of the traditions, we try to go to church on, you know, Christmas Eve, midnight mass. You know, and we open a gift from each other on Christmas Eve, and then the Secret Santa.
You do Secret Santa. We all know what Secret Santa is, but it's a small family. How do you do it?
Yeah, just between the girls, there's a, you know, now there's an app actually where you all sign in, and then you know, the app gives you who to, you know, get the gift for. So, you know, we do that, and, you know, I try to get them to, you know, watch a few movies, and my favorite, Christmas special is, you know, The Year Without a Santa Claus, because I, you know, love the Heat Miser and the, you know, Cold Miser, you know, and the songs and that. So that's my favorite Christmas special. You want to know what my favorite movie is?
We're going to talk about that next week.
Okay.
Hold off on that one.
All right. I will. Hold off.
Yeah. So what about you and the missus? Or first of all, are all the girls, it's five girls, correct?
Correct.
Are they all coming in? Are they all already in?
No, they're all coming in. We have one in New York that will be coming in. And then, so, you know, we have 26 down to 11. So we try to keep the peace, keep the holiday spirit going, keep the controversies down, which sometimes can be difficult, but, you know, that's the objective, so to speak. And, you know, enjoy the, you know, the whole thing together and, you know, the rest of the holidays into the new year.
You bring up a very good point. Everybody always knocks, Thanksgiving, have to deal with Uncle Louie, have to deal with this, have to deal with that. Look, that's family year round. You're at each other's throat. But that's because you're so open towards one another and you wear your emotions and love on the sleeves. Of course you're going to have disagreements. Of course you're going to argue. Of course you're going to bicker, but you're going to have great times too. Why? Because blood does keep you together and you love your brother or your sister regardless. One of the things that bothers me, Bill, are all these progressives saying, well, don't go do Thanksgiving. Don't do Christmas. They're vile people. They voted for this. Well, there is no family in the history of civilization since Adam and Eve were kicked out of paradise that has ever had an event where they agree on 100%. But that's what makes family family. You can disagree and come together. So, Bill, I always view what you said there about, hey, got to keep the peace. There's always going to be battles in the war of ideology, whether it's your favorite show to politics. That's what kind of makes the love come together. So there's always that one person that comes in and goes, enough, enough. It's Christmas. Drink your eggnog. And y'all take your eggnog like. And then you hug each other and you love one another. And then you enjoy that favorite show. You laugh at the dumb joke. You go, hey, I do like your boyfriend there. It all comes together. You have the final word, Bill, before we close it out. Your thoughts.
Well, I agree with that. And it makes it more interesting when you have a little controversy, as long as you can manage it and then bring it back together, right?
Right.
So, you know, no, I agree. And I always, it's one of my favorite times of the year, you know, because obviously we have a couple scattered. We have a couple in college. So it's always nice to get them back. And then they can share time with their, you know, younger sister, their 11-year-old sister, who they don't see all the time, right? As long as they, you know, as long as they give the parents a break, well, then everything will go fine.
That you say that, but you look so forward to seeing the whole clan together, you know, at that time, you know. And with that, my friends, I'm sorry, Bill, you have one more comment?
No, I don't. I agree. I won't comment on that.
So, and with that, my friends, we will close the show out. I hope you enjoyed it. We had some heavy talk. We obviously went here 119 or at 120 mark, but it was heavy. We revisited the Duke lacrosse saga, and I hope you realize nothing's changed from the progressive media, from Democrat politicians. It's actually gotten worse. We have to come together as Latinos, whites, blacks, Asians, whatever you want to call us, Native American, Indians, whatever, and make the change, because the powers that be want us at each other's throats. We both think Bill Belichick will succeed at UNC. To what extent, we don't know, but it's going to be fun to watch. And Mr. Campbell, it's the holiday season, so I pray you can find some peace from that anger that keeps you at odds with your current employers in the NFL, and you can come back and have a fruitful career. My friends, I am William Del Pilar for Mr. Bill Ross and Points on the Board. Until next time, we bid you adieu.